Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet and Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How you doing, Frank?
Hi, David. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Right. So we are now on 3 weeks since the tragic murder of George Floyd, which has spurred protests across the United States and around the world, but has also prompted a reconsideration of the monumental landscape with monuments to the Confederacy coming down a number of places, but also monuments to Christopher Columbus, monuments to Frank Rhodes, police chief and mayor of Philadelphia. There's been debates over monuments in other places, and so we want to talk about monuments today. And
if I can interrupt, also globally, I mean, of course, the monument thing really got rolling last week in Bristol, England, when Edward Colston was chucked into the river and King Leopold was pulled down in Antwerp. So this has been a global movement.
To be sure. And there's the debate over the Rhodes statue in Oxford.
Yeah.
And debates over monuments here in Edinburgh as well.
Yeah. Sorry. Well,
to be sure, right? So to talk about monuments, we thought we'd bring in somebody who actually knows something about the topic, at least more than we do, because I know listeners are tired of us talking about topics we only have some mild familiarity with. And so we decided to bring in my dear friend, Hillary Green, into this conversation. Hi, Hillary. Very glad you could make it here with us today.
Thank you, David and Frank, for having me.
I'm imagining many of our listeners know Hillary's work, but for those who don't, she's the Associate Professor of History in the Department of Gender and Race Studies at the University of Alabama. She is the author of a really wonderful book, Educational Reconstruction, and also is the founder of the Hallowed Grounds Tours of the University of Alabama campus, which I guess you're going to have to edit the tour soon because the monumental landscape there has changed. And so your scholarship and advocacy is responsible for, I think, at least some credit for the removal of the monuments earlier this week on the University of Alabama campus. And I think you also get partial credit for Silent Sam, too. So you're remaking the landscape on campuses around the South. So, Hillary, tell me about your original response when you heard that the monuments on your campus were going to be taken down. Tell us something about what these monuments were and what the sort of backstory is behind them.
The first thing I will say is I was in shock because I got an email in my office at 5 o'clock in the afternoon from the university saying they issued a joint statement that they were removing these markers. And I am currently scoring the AP grading right now. So I'm like, well, let me walk from my office to the quad where these were. And my shock was they were already removed. The university, by the time they emailed out the community of faculty, staff, in our newsletter, they have already been pulled. So these were three major plaques and then the actual boulder itself. So two plaques were on the university library, the Gorgas Library. They were dedicated for the first library after Gorgas. That's now Carmichael Hall. And it was like lost cause. We're going to honor the valid UA defenders of the campus, of the cadets who were there, who valiantly defended the campus on April 3rd and April 4th. We also were going to talk about our alumni who served in the Confederacy, but it's all within that 19-teens time period. Those were plaques that moved with the library. So when Carmichael Hall, when the library moved from Carmichael Hall to its current location, those plaques moved with it. So they've already, that's its second location. So they've been moved. The other one that's more important, though, was our UDC boulder that was dedicated in the early 19-teens. It is United Daughters of the Confederacy. It's a big rock that's on our quad. That's in its second location. It was originally closer to the steps of the library where they are now. It was elevated on a mini mound, and it had a brick enclosure around it. During the dedication of that that boulder, B.B. Comer's there, former governor. They're doing a whole rebel yell. It's a It's a lost cause event. They're also giving diplomas to all former students who served during the Civil War but didn't graduate. So it's a graduation ceremony for the current students of that year, plus the Civil War generation. And the United Daughters of the Confederacy actually has their annual meeting in Tuscaloosa surrounding this. So it's a huge lost cause event. So this is this massive rock that's on our quad with a plaque on it. And when I, and so for me, the shock when I got down there, I was taking a picture. One of the strategic communications individuals was there. She was like, hey, you need to go down and see the rock because they already removed the plaque from it. So I went down and saw it, and I was in disbelief that it was just a rock without the plaque. And I'm like, I teach this. I'm always reminding my students of this monument. We're in front of it all the time. And I was so shocked at how fast, how quickly the university mobilized, where we've been fighting for this and other of our mandates for the past, what, since I've been there. So the speed in which they removed it was just awe-shocking to me.
Yeah, it is really, you know, intriguing how quickly these things happened after, you know, years and years of conversation. You know, these monuments, as you mentioned, are put up 50 years after the war was over. What was going on in Alabama that sort of helps provide some context for that moment in which people are putting up monuments to the Confederacy?
Yes, this is truly, I call them Jim Crow monuments. They come after disenfranchisement, so after our 1901 Constitution, it is gone. Black men can't vote. It is fully segregated. There's a racial geography there. And so you start seeing monuments that move from cemeteries with the Ladies Memorial Association. We have that early phase. But once Jim Crow was in and enshrined, that's where they really come up in large numbers. So in Alabama, between 1900 and 1922, you get some in the 1930s, especially when they try to put some on Gettysburg and other places. But it's really, it is to say, this is white rule, white supremacy. This is where we get our state archives. This is white only spaces. This is white only history. This is our version of the Civil War. All other versions, you don't matter. And telling black people in the height of lynching in Alabama, you don't matter either. You have cultural geography telling you don't matter, and then you have lynch mobs killing people who speak out. So they bought the silence and the complicity of people who are living in fear and have no choice other than in the spaces they control, black churches, that they can control that. But it is stamping down. We are the state. We are. It is a Jim Crow era. White rule, white supremacy, that is the norm.
Yeah. Now, I think that seems to be the case for monuments really across the South, right? That this is it's that moment in the first couple decades of the 20th century when most of these monuments get erected. When did you start giving these tours?
So I started research for the tours in January 2015. My first tour was done in August of 2015. And it was because of a student that I started doing these tours at the University of Alabama. The reason why I know the exact date, because I remember the lecture. And I had a black male student who bought the myth that UA was telling about its landscape, that slavery did not exist there. So we were talking about slavery at college campuses, and I was talking about UNC Chapel Hill, UVA, and brought in Alabama. And he was questioning the content, like, why are we studying this? Slavery didn't exist here. And I had to do pull up the library page, pull up the digitized receipts. And then after that, as I always tell people, and David, you would know this, and Frank, too, is teaching the classroom, it only takes one student before it gets in the syllabus. So, I went from intellectual curiosity of one building, like, oh, who are the slaves, to like, no, we're going to walk the campus. We're going to develop a class. We're going to develop a lecture that we can do in a Tuesday, Thursday lecture model. And we're going to walk into Alabama heat. And no students are ever going to say that slavery didn't exist here. And we're going to use the surviving buildings of slavery at the university and walk that world. So you'll walk the geography of the enslaved. And so from August 2015 to now, due to COVID, my last tour was at the end of February. I'm almost at 5,000 people reached in person on a tour.
Wow.
Wow. Congratulations.
That's a huge impact. Now, what kinds of people are signing up for the tour? Are these students? Are they members of faculty? Are they visitors? Who are the people who sign up for the tours?
Yeah, so initially it would have been students, and largely students of color in intro to AFAM studies and intro to women's studies classes, because that comes out of my department. But then it quickly expanded to guest lecturers in the history department, education, social work. And then for Black History Month, I started doing public tours because people were emailing me like, hey, I heard about this tour. Are you doing any for the public? So I started doing tours once a week during Black History Month. And that's how the public started to come in. Now, I have, especially after the election, 2016 election, the diversity of the people taking the tours have completely shifted. It is largely white individuals of all ages, high school students to older individuals, people who are pushing their children in strollers, the spouses of our international faculty, of the and of the Mercedes plants. It is a wide swath of people from the campus community, Tuscaloosa city and county, some visiting professors like Michael Fitzgerald. He always brings his students from St. Olaf College every other year. So I get St. Olaf College students. I get students from the University of Delaware. And then the administration, whenever they have a special guest come through, they're like, hey, I heard about this tour. Can we sign up? So I get emails sometimes from the administration like, hey, do you have time? So
that's interesting to hear that, because one can imagine an administration having a very different kind of response to a tour that's about the racial violence embedded on campus.
Well, you know, it's funny. Seeing tourism in my first book on Black education, I realized civic boosters, they will go after any market and they will market it accordingly. So I am an alternate campus tour that has a market appeal to a segment that they want to tap into. So even though it's not the main tour, there's enough of an audience that they're like, oh, is this a way to buy them into the Alabama brand? So it's the same cycle with plantation tours that are now doing Behind the Big House tour. It's that market that they want, and they see anyone interested in good publicity is bringing us in. So what has surprised me was that, but my dean of arts and sciences, my chair, my associate deans, they were on board from the beginning. And the administration, I think they thought I was going to go away, and then it just kept on growing. So I said, yeah, up until this week, I'm like, I would say they tolerated me. These tours. Anything else. Yeah.
Obviously, they've had an about face in the past 2 weeks. But what was their official position about why they were keeping these plaques, why they were keeping buildings named after enslavers on campus? What was the sort of official explanation for why these things persisted for so long?
It's because of history and tradition. This is our traditional campus, and the university is very weird because they preserved the built landscape. So our quad was original to the enslaved campus that was hand cut by enslaved people. So what do you do with this physical space that is so tied between that Jim Crow up to the present? So they were like, well, we're building new buildings, reflecting new values, but this shows the complicated history of all of UA. But not challenging the perceptions of people, not educating people of what they're seeing. So they could walk the campus and not see the boulder. They could walk in front of the steps of the library and never see those plaques because they're not choosing to look for them. There's nothing to tell them that they're there. So they literally are stumbling across the campus and have to interpret themselves. So it's a way like, if we don't talk about it, it's fine. Also, too, the university put up a marker apologizing for slavery. That is not on the official tour. People don't know where it is unless you go over, take the tour, or you go to the biology building. So they were doing a bad job of either promoting the stuff that they added, new markers, but also not contextualizing the existing campus. So it became a, well, this is UA. We've always been this way. The other was we might lose students. And then third is it's not that big of a deal. We gave them a marker. We gave them the slavery apology marker. That should be sufficient. So for me, doing these tours, I was like, I have to educate people of what they're walking on every day and bring in new narratives and have them to see the campus differently. So it's that education piece that helped push through the purposeful silences of the landscape itself and the intentional not explaining what they were seeing. So people got it was normalized to them. So they never knew there was a problem. But I encountered students all the time who cannot walk into certain building names, buildings named after John Tyler Morgan, B.B. Comer, Josiah Knott. Even I have problems walking into those building names and saying the names after the building. And I had to talk students out of transferring from UA because of the violence that they feel every single time. And some markers, the Boulder being one, once they learned about it, they're like, can we blow it up? I'm like, no, can't blow this up. But what can we do about it? Let's have these conversations. So that petition came from students, and I saw the organizers. Many of them have been on the tour, have taken my classes. They fully learned the history. And then they started saying, we are at Bama too. These are our campus. We don't reflect that past. We are the future. We matter. We need to really have this conversation. And I think years of education from the tours, classes, having that and having students realize that they did not have to accept the landscape as is. They had power. And for them, they chose petitioning and sitting in offices. They didn't go the vandalism route, but they did that. And with George Floyd and all the other monuments coming down, UA took the decision. And like most things on the campus, when they remove things, it's so done quickly, they don't tell you it got moved. They took it down.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds, you know, the narrative at Alabama is very similar to the kinds of narratives you're having at that universities across the South, you know, and Chapel Hill, where we both went, had similar dialogue. And of course, there the students decided to pull down the statue before when the university refused to. Frank wants to challenge us with some questions, though, about this whole monumental landscape thing.
Well, hold on, David. I don't want to challenge. I want to play devil's advocate and run through a couple of questions.
Okay, I'm ready.
Isn't that what devil... Anyway, it's the same thing. Right.
But actually, before that, Hillary, I'm interested if I can just ask a couple of follow-ups based on what you just said. Has there been any backlash against the removal of the boulder or the plaques in the past week?
No. Because of COVID, we are shut down, really. There's hardly anyone on campus. But one of the things I have seen, because a lot of the students who are here, they are part of the current protest movement. So it's been more celebration, not too much of the negative voices coming out. And in fact, because it came from the top, it was a top-down decision, joint decision. I think that mattered more. If it was pulled down like a silent Sam, I think there would have been more negative. But the way it was packaged and communicated, kind of like, we at the top agree with this. We did it. So if you got to challenge it, you have to challenge us at the top.
Interesting, interesting. And when was the plaque put up for enslaved people at Alabama?
That was done in 2006. The apology for the university that they made in 2004, and it's almost 2 years to the date.
Right. And was there a debate about the wording of that apology and the wording on the plaque?
Well, that was a lovely debate in the faculty senate, and which those records are on board, including the one person who voted to abstain and gave a public speech. So it's really nice to see all of this stuff. And then the language, it's moderated. You know, the wordsmiths of public relations got on that and everything else when monuments go up and markers go up. And everyone was not always happy with it. But one of the things I do like about it, it mentions three enslaved people on there. You see the people and the humanity. And it also has the apology from the faculty because they were once responsible for renting out and hiring of enslaved people and the administration. So two dates of Wendell's apologies there. So you get a history of that, but the history of the protests that led up to that gets erased.
Right. Interesting. Thank you. Right. Okay. So for Hillary and David, I've got a series of questions for both of you to kind of frame our discussion. So I will put these to you and moderate this, I suppose. And these are things that have come up, I think, in the past week or so as we've started to debate this stuff. Well, not started, but continued the debate around the world. So the first one, and these will be familiar to you, I think, is taking down statues erases history.
Yes. That one. All right. So for me, one of the things, as someone who does African-American history and is researching African-American memory, Civil War sites for African-Americans got bulldozed for the sake of progress because of urban renewal. Their sites have been bulldozed and removed for gentrification. And no one ever complained in the 1950s and 60s when these things were coming down. In fact, they're told, like, your memories don't matter. You just need to move. So seeing the African-American community deal with the anger of their sites removed, and then the flip now is people like, you didn't care about our memory. You didn't care about our monument, so why should we care? So the true erasure of the history occurred with early on in this debate with African-American memory. And also, too, monuments don't teach history. They reflect one view. In a poor view at that. So they're not erasing history. They kind of already did. And these lost cause memorials erase the African-American memory, erase the Native American Civil War story, erase the conscientious objectors. It is not truly reflective of what the Civil War was. It's just one lost cause interpretation. So in itself, it has already erased history. So we're not erasing anything. We're actually adding and making a full reckoning of the fuller story rather than a selected story.
David, thank you, Hillary.
I mean, I would agree with everything Hillary says, as I probably will, you know, for everything. One of the monuments are about people at a particular moment in time trying to impose their ideas about power and their ideas about the past onto the future, you know. And as Hillary pointed out, you know, most of the Confederate monuments are actually Jim Crow monuments that are put up long after the Civil War is over, at a moment of enormous racial violence and inequality, and it's about trying to impose that version of the past on to future generations. So, you know, that's that moment saying, here's what we think is important, and here's what we're going to share with you. And I don't think we're bound by what racist people 100 centuries ago thought should be on the landscape any more than I'm bound by what the previous tenant of my flat thought the right color for the walls should be. You know, the fact that it's old, moderately old, doesn't make it historically valuable, especially when it's doing tremendous violence to people in the present. And our ability to remember the past is not predicated upon there being monuments to it. You know, people know who George III is in New York City, despite the fact that they tore down that monument pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. People are going to know who Saddam Hussein was in Iraq, even though those monuments are gone. People know who the Nazis were in Germany, even though they've destroyed all of, you know, most of the sort of monumental landscape connected with them. So, you know, our history, our understanding of the past is not shaped by our monumental landscape. Yes. Okay. So tear them all down.
Thank you. Well, we'll get to that. Hold on.
Okay.
What about this one? They were men and women, although we're mainly talking about men in this case. They were men and women of their time. And so we're imposing the values of the present on the past when we do this. Hillary?
They were men and women who oppressed other people and purposely did not give others a choice to decide what those monuments would look like. So they are products of our complicated racial past and products of oppression and long legacies of oppression. And I think that's why they become a flashpoint at this moment, is that how do you have, when you're talking about modern day oppression, and then you have this monument in front of you that you see every day, you have to witness every day, you refuse to acknowledge because that person at the time would never acknowledge you as your humanity. it's why I think there's a backlash coming down that they feel like they don't have a say. They don't have a democratic process to remove it. They don't have a choice in that decision. No one's listening to them like the original people who put up the monuments did. So it's that longer through line and legacy I see for them.
Okay.
That's the one little bit I'd add to that is that a lot of Confederate monuments are not put up in spite of the fact that these were racist people of their time. They're put up because they were racist people of their time, and that's their support of white supremacy and slavery is why the monument is, and their willingness to fight for it is part of why those monuments are there. You know, and it's sort of part, you know, the monumental landscape that's being erected in the early part of the 20th century is being erected at the same time that the legal frameworks of segregation are being put in place. And those two things are fit together. Right?
And I'll add to that, too, the SPLC chart of the where the monuments are. My students are always struck because I always teach lynching beforehand. And they're like, when they look at the Deep South and the former Confederate states and where those monuments are, and then they look at the lynching map that that has come out, they're like, that's kind of overlaid like directly there. And being in Alabama and being, I've been to the Montgomery Lynching Memorial now 10 times with students and guests. They see those connections. They see the connections with the modern day policing, and they're seeing all of that. So these racist individuals at the time who put up these racist monuments, and now we're dealing with the racism of the current legal system.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that there's so many of these monuments right in front of courthouses, you know, I think sort of speaks to the ways in which they're trying to impose a kind of white supremacist model on the Southern legal system that exists to this day.
Okay, one more that one we've heard a lot in the past week, and we've heard different variations on this, including from the White House press secretary. So if if we start by taking down statues of Columbus or Robert E. Lee, etc., where will it end? I give you another example of this, which was Senator Tom Cotton said in the Senate last week. We're going to be renaming the Washington Monument. It will become the Obelisk of Wokeness. Now, leaving aside the fact that the Obelisk of Wokeness is a very cool name, you know, what about this? It's a slippery slope. If we start with people like Robert E. Lee and Columbus, where will it end?
As someone who teaches at the University of Alabama and has heard those arguments for a long time, including the we gave him a marker from fellow faculty ones, where does it end? I'm like, well, we need to have a conversation. Removing markers is the easy part. But if you don't have the logic behind the people down the road, it doesn't matter. And you're to say that is a way to not listen, to not be, and to just like deflect. And I think that's going to cause more problems. So for me, I have problems with anything for people who enacted racialized terror. That is my bar. That is my bar. I'm like, they don't deserve any monuments. If you could be a Klansman, a terrorist, or anything else like that, you do not need a marker. And if that's the, and then the other one is the question I would ask, does it cause people pain? And if we can't start with those two, it doesn't matter where. So for me, Columbus, the beheading of Columbus in Boston, and I'm a Boston native, by the way. So I was like, whoa, that's a little, okay. they're coming all down. So I think Columbus, I think the Confederate monuments, I think the ones of extreme acts of violence that are causing people pain might be the ones to start with. And then the other ones, it's going to be community by community determine who these people are that needs to come down. But for me, this is also what do you replace it with? I'm not sold on replacing it with anything. Like, if it comes out, like, can we do something else, like a reflection park? Can we do something, but don't put up another monument? What can we do to promote reconciliation and healing? Rather than where does it end? Where do we go from here once it's down? I think that's the question that we should be asking.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah,
David?
She's taking all the good answers. you know, the I think we do need to have a discussion, and I think there about why we commemorate people in monuments anyway, and why putting a statue up of somebody, what that's supposed to mean in a broader philosophical sense. And, you know, there does seem to be a moment in time when a lot of these statues are put up. I mean, the late 19th and early 20th century, they like to put up a lot of statues. There are relatively few statues that have been put up in recent decades by comparison to anything, just because we're not, you know, we're not, I guess, a culture that values that kind of monumental landscape in the same way. I guess we have the Rocky statue in Philadelphia, and I'm fine with that, mostly. But, you know, the anytime you put somebody on a pedestal, literally or figuratively, you know, I think we're opening them up to scrutiny. And I think, you know, that includes, you know, the obelisk of wokeness, which is a problematic monument in other ways. You know, and one of the things that tearing down these monuments does is it actually causes people to discuss these people and really examine them. I mean, the situation in Bristol with the Edward Colston statue that got thrown in the river. He's been discussed more in the past week than he was in the previous 100 years, you know, and the legacy of slavery in Bristol and the ways in which questions about philanthropy and the kind of exploitative capitalism that the slave trade generated, you know, those relationships, I think, are discussions that have come because the thing got chucked in the river that we wouldn't be having otherwise. And I think the value of the statues now we have it chucked in the river. You know, there's a question about what to do in these spaces. And Hillary, correct me if I'm wrong, but first they removed the plaque from the boulder and then they removed the boulder itself?
Yes, they did.
You see, I'd almost wish they'd kept the boulder there with the empty place in it. Because, you know, then you have a discussion then about, okay, here's what used to be here, and here's why that's not here anymore.
I will continue to teach that, because I have the visual record.
Sure,
and,
to be sure.
So that's the way, but yeah, I'm concerned that we won't have this conversation, because I thought the empty rock would have been better. But
better, yeah. You know, at Duke University, after Charlottesville, maybe, or maybe it was after, a few years ago, somebody took a hammer to a statue of Robert E. Lee on Duke University campus. They had a statue of him on the chapel right next to a statue of Thomas Jefferson. Frank, you'll be happy to know no one attacked Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yes, so he's still there, at least for the time being. But someone took a hammer to him, and Duke decided to take the statue down but leave the empty spot there on the chapels. And so when you walk into the chapel, there's a very obvious sort of like place where there was a statue next to some other statues, one of whom is TJ.
Well, I think, go ahead, David.
And I think that sort of negative space, you know, invites a conversation about why we're putting people on pedestals. It invites us the story of, okay, here's why this person was on the pedestal in the first place. Here's why it's no longer on the pedestal. What are the kinds of values we want to honor with places of power? And those conversations, I think, are important conversations that having an empty pedestal invites.
Yeah, and this one, they said they're going to put it in a museum. Those two plaques are in the library next to the archival records in there, so you can actually go see them, probably going to see them again and do research, like our United Dogs of Confederacy Tiffany stained glass window that we still have that hasn't been attacked because it's in the archive. So you have to go to the archives to see it, and then you have the room that you can pull the materials to study it. So it will be studied, but removing it from the quad, it's this question of what's going to go next. And I think that's when I talked about what do we do there. The university has a full-out group of people to deal with the entire landscape and what to do next. So we're finally having there. So if it's going to be another piece of art there, I don't know. But the boulder is still intact. We just don't know where it is.
Secure and undisclosed location.
Pretty much like Silent Sam.
Yeah, well,
I find it interesting that these... sorry, David, I find it interesting that the way the statue of Robert E. Lee on Monument Avenue in Richmond has been appropriated by protesters in the past 2 weeks. And to some extent, it's taken on a completely different meaning as a result. Yeah. And I think when I see the photos of it, I think, well, maybe they should leave it up. You know?
I would love it to be up, but also, too, if they move it, I want it not cleaned.
Yes,
I want
that's right.
History with all of the graffiti, all the African-Americans who've been pushing back, dancing on it, doing everything that they've been doing since 1890 when it got put up.
I'd be okay.
Part of the history.
I'd be okay if they removed Lee from the statue and just left the statue of Traveler there.
Ooh.
Because the horse didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly.
The thinking about sort of these sort of spaces, you know, at Chapel Hill, and I don't know whether you've been back, Hillary, since Silent Sam, you know, they toppled the statue, then the university removed the pedestal, you know, and now they have anti-racist picnics on the spot. But if you didn't know that was the spot, there's nothing on the landscape to tell you what used to be there unless you happen to know that. And students are taking it upon themselves to have these picnics. To sort of remember that moment, but that, you know, may disappear with time and memory.
I think it will, because I had a chance to go over there, and I had to recall where it was, and which I was like, oh, but I also, when I was a student there, I tried to avoid the statue at all costs. I wouldn't have to deal with that every day. So my geography, my movement around the campus was shaped by that. Same thing with Monument Avenue, where I go to the research in Richmond. So for me, I just remember I could walk there head up high, did not have to see it all the time. Mm. But I did do a kind of leap for joy over the spot. But to remind myself, like, I could do this now.
Yeah, well, it's a very powerful thing, though. I mean, I think lots of students of color have that sort of experience where they're actually changing the ways in which they move around space to avoid interacting with buildings and monuments and things that you know, are evoke some a really tragic history. And I'm not sure that the university administrators are always aware of the ways in which people are modifying their behavior.
Yeah, which is why I think the question I say, like, a starting point is, does this cause pain? It's a valid one, because we don't even ask how people feel about these things and how they go and change their behavior, well, consciously or subconsciously, to avoid pain, to avoid trauma. And so for me, I think one of the things with Silent Sam and then also UA, it's so community-based. I would like to have a conversation in both places, like with current stakeholders, like, should we leave it empty? What should we put here? How do we do this? How do we acknowledge the moment? But let them decide rather than be like, okay, we're going to permanently have this here. But then, too, using curricula, having a museum, which we don't have on our campus except for one for Bear Bryant and a natural history museum, and the Gorgas House, which is the first house on our campus. But can we bring the history of the removal, the history of the other things that the university has removed about its Confederate past and slavery into a space that we can have these productive and healthy but also contextualized conversations?
Yeah, I mean, this question about sort of local conversations, I think, is really important, and they've been hampered in lots of places by state laws that really sort of prohibit the removal of these monuments. I mean, you know, North Carolina, the thing over Silent Sam was always fraught because the state law said you can't move it, and I think Alabama has a similar law. I don't know whether it applies to campus or not, but Virginia just repealed their law, I think, and so that's sort of part of the debate over removing them now is different because local communities can make those kinds of choices.
And that's the thing. So I live in Birmingham, so our mayor boxed it and then had a series of lawsuits in which I had to talk about the history of that. But that's one of the things what caused the recent conversations on our campus that stopped it. Well, there's Alabama law. Well, thanks to my friends at the Alabama Department of Archives and History, Cultural Resources, they're like, you know, UA's exempt from this. They even pointed to the page and the line. So I was like, thank you for this ammunition. And it's delivered it. The other thing is, it was not really well written. you get assessed one $25,000 fine, and then that's it. So they're busily rewriting this. So that's why you're seeing campaigns in Birmingham, like, for $25,000. So they're now GoFundMe campaigns to get around the loopholes of these laws.
So, yeah, so the price for tearing them down is $25,000. That's not a bad...
And okay. So there's, like, one in Huntsville right now. And now our attorney general is like, oh, wait. And then he's trying to go in, realizing, like, the law is the way it's written, and these communities finally figured this out. So Birmingham paying their $25,000. Mobile is probably going to do that. Huntsville's fundraising right now, and it's all GoFundMe. And they're like, okay, we have this, take it down. So the law has been an obstacle. And I think about the discussion point and why these monuments sometimes are being pulled down by protesters. They tried to go through and appeal. They tried to follow the law, but they were shut down immediately. So the law became a way to say no, rather than a law to say, okay, we'll work with you type of thing. So this is where laws have actually, I think, contributed to what we're seeing as well, and the places we're seeing it. And including my campus, we were exempt from it, and we had waivers, so we could have taken it down, and we took it down.
Interesting. I've got a more complicated question for you guys. I mean, those first three are the things we've heard a lot over the past weeks and months, but this one's more complicated because I think it comes from the other side of the spectrum. So in today's Observer here in the UK, there's a column by David Olusoga, who's a professor of public history at the University of Manchester. He's been very outspoken in support of the Black Lives Matter movement in recent weeks, throughout his career, but has also had a lot to say about this question of statues. And he wrote this today, so if you'll bear with me, I'll read this quote. "Those who hope and believe that this moment could bring about real social change have to confront a difficult question. If forced to choose between a proper national debate on racism," and he's referring to the UK here, "or the statue wars, which is it to be? Of course, there should be no binary choice here, but I fear that there might be." So I think what's behind this is, yesterday, Saturday, we saw rioting in London by white supremacists and white nationalists who were seeking to protect, and I'm using air quotes here, to protect the statue of Winston Churchill, which had been vandalized the previous week by BLM activists during demonstrations in London. And so we've had a debate about statues, but Olusoga is making the point that, is this the wrong debate, or does it distract from the larger debate we need to have about civil rights and racial justice?
You know, as you gave me a heads up on it earlier, now as I think about it, I think one of the things is I could see this, and I'll give the example of my campus. The apology marker was done in apology for slavery was done in 2004. The apology marker was put up in 2006. And I've had several of my white faculty, largely STEM, and others say, well, we gave them a marker, and as if to shut down the rest of the conversation. And rather than deal with the systemic systems and the complex legacies of that violence. So I think for now, I'm grateful. It is a distraction, but it's the monuments are part of the symptom of racism. It's a part of that longer history and entrenched legacy. And I think that removing the marker is step one. That's the easy part. Add in a new marker, removing markers is the easy thing. How do we stop it from instead of we gave them a marker, we removed the marker? And I could see that coming in, and I respect that conversation. It's that distraction that we don't get to that deeper discussion afterwards. So for me, I've always said this is step one. This is not the next. This is the easy. This is the low-hanging fruit. How do then we go from there? But one of the things that I can see is, how do we keep this momentum once the marker or statue is down, that we actually go to the next conversations? And that is the deep entrenched history of slavery and racism. And that's the harder, and that's going to be the harder and most difficult conversation, because that means listening, empathy, institutional support, and long-term sustainable and large financial contributions to have these conversations. And that is where, can we get the will of the people and the will of the support to go forward? So for me, I could see the fear, and I could see for some using it as a distraction, but for a lot of the people out there, I see them taking the same mentality. This is step one. Let's have this, get this, and then move forward. So how do we keep that momentum is the hard part. But it shouldn't be a binary, but I can see from the top down, because I've seen it here. I've seen it all over. That we gave a marker and added the marker to we removed the marker, and therefore we don't have to do anything else. And that's the problem. I think that's I could see that binary where we go from here. And I'm glad he put that out there, because that's a conversation that I know on my campus with my chair and other people were like, okay, this is great. What do we do from here that we don't stop the momentum and stop these conversations? Because we know it's easy to default to what's easy. And that's removal. Then you don't have to do the hard work.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Thank you, David. Yeah.
Well, I would just, you know, add that, you know, we're in, I think, the third wave of removals of Confederate symbols in the past 5 years, right? So we had the Confederate flag disappeared from lots of places after the mass shooting in Charleston. We could have had a debate there about gun violence, but we decided to take that in Confederate flag instead. You know, a couple years ago after Charlottesville, we could have had a debate about militarized white supremacy in the present, but we took down some Confederate monuments, you know, and now we're having this debate. So I think there's, you know, a point at which sometimes the monument, taking down the monuments, taking down the symbols is, as Hillary says, the relatively easy work, whereas dismantling white supremacy and racist structures is much more challenging. You know, that being said, I think monuments are powerful, and I think monuments, you know, the things we choose to glorify by putting them on a flagpole or by putting them on a pedestal, those things matter. They matter about what we're saying about the past. They matter about what we say about the present, you know, and if we can get ourselves in a system that doesn't have obvious symbols of white supremacy floating around and being sort of part of the everyday lives of Americans, where people have to change the path they take when they walk around campus to avoid running into the symbols, I think that will make it easier for us to have these harder conversations, as always says, about the structures of white supremacy that are undergirding lots of American society and society in the UK and society around the world. You know, renaming military bases to get rid of all the ones that are named after Confederates, I think, is a great idea. I think that will help make our military less racist or less of a place where racists feel like they can go, potentially. You know, I think getting rid of Confederate flags in NASCAR is great. And if anybody wants to boycott NASCAR because they don't have Confederate flags there, then, you know, that, so be it. You know, I'm not a big NASCAR guy, but, you know, like, the fact that, you know, Taylor Swift came out against Nathan Bedford Forrest the other day. I think those kinds of movements, even if they are symbolic and even if they don't actually lead to change in and of themselves, I think they will set the groundwork for conversations that will lead to change. So.
And then the other thing I'll add is, and I saw this on my campus, after Charlottesville, I got several emails from people who worked on the campus for years, did not know that we had a UDC boulder on our quad. They didn't know it was there. This is a big, solid, massive
It's rock. A boulder in the middle of campus.
I got emails like they didn't know where it was. They had no idea it was there. So one of the things about these defenders of monuments, only why they're now defending it, because they're now aware that they even exist. And they feel like in this current white supremacist moment of neo-Confederacy, neo-lost cause, that they have to defend it. But before, they had no clue that it existed, where it was. All they know is there's a way now within this current political moment of racism and oppression that they can then defend. Because they can defend, they know that, but they had no idea about the history, where it was, or anything else. So I think this is where the diversity of the people in those crowds really matter to me. it's not a black only spaces. They are so rich and so diverse. I'm like, okay, we can have a meaningful conversation. So I think it's going to be different than a Charlottesville. It's going to be different than a Charleston. And the fifth year anniversary is coming up, and that's a difficult one for me because of my family on the South Carolina side. I've spent time in that space. I know the families. I know some of the victims. But we didn't have those conversations. Instead, we were telling those communities, you need to forgive. We need to take down these symbols, and that's it. But then we have Charlottesville, this one. But this one's different. This feels different. And it feels different in a way because of the people in the crowd to reclaiming is much more massive in scope, richness, and diversity that I think we might have it, but it's how to keep that going once the physical symbol's done. And that activism, okay, we got that, and then we're done. And stopping that conversation, yeah.
I think that's a brilliant place to leave things. I mean, Hillary, we're so grateful to you for your insight and your wisdom and your good cheer and your time, especially when you're grading exams early in the morning. So, I hope you'll come on again. This was really, really wonderful.
Thank you so much for both of you for having me here and working with my schedule. I had fun.
All right. I'm grading exams. All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.